Hello, I'm Mariëtte Snyman. Welcome to Calm, Clear and Helpful, a weekly podcast series on taking good care of yourself and others, introducing you to wellness professionals ready to assist, inform and inspire. Today we're looking at how women experience ADHD differently from men. My guest is Marina Wildt, wellness coach specializing in chronic illness and pain management from Johannesburg. Welcome back on the show, Marina.
Thank you so much for having me, Mariëtte. I'm so excited to have this conversation with you because I really feel that discussing something like ADHD and the effects that it has on women is such an important topic that we often overlook. I'm excited to get into it.
Absolutely. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us. After our conversation, Marina will give us tips for people living with ADHD, and then it will be fun question time. Marina, we've recorded a podcast on your journey with chronic pain and illness and how to cope with day-to-day life when this is a given. But for those who haven't heard this episode, could you please explain what you do?
Absolutely. So for everyone new who is listening in, my name is Marina, and I work as a wellness coach that does specialize in chronic illness, chronic pain, and mental health support. My journey into this work is definitely very personal, as I was diagnosed with a very serious nerve condition when I was 16. That left me wheelchair-bound for well over a decade and forced to rely on mobility aids up until about the age of 27. My process in healing has been what has inspired me to build and create the brand I do have. And today I run an organization called Heal, which is a platform that's dedicated to helping people manage chronic illness, stress management, burnout. And within the platform, I want to and do my best to offer that deep and founding support that each one of us really needs when we are going through any form of chronic diagnosis, whether it is something like ADHD or something that presents more physically, take for example cerebral palsy or multiple sclerosis. And the objective is to bring individuals together to feel comforted, to feel safe, to feel heard, and to provide all the possible information, resources, and tools to make your journey through healing as comfortable as possible. And what I have found and what's so interesting about what we're going to talk about today is that when I started this journey in building my brand, ADHD wasn't actually the prime focus. But today, it's become one of the main things I talk about. And I'm so eager to start sharing why and how I've also had to upskill my knowledge and expertise in assisting with ADHD as part of a chronic diagnosis, or why it's as prevalent as it is. Yeah, I'm looking forward to diving into that and sharing a little bit more about what we do and ways that you can start to either identify symptoms or things that you've noticed within yourself that feel not normal in quotation marks, or feel like they make you different, or feel like they make you unheard. So that's me in a nutshell. And as a little additional thing, sorry that I forgot to mention, I'm also currently completing my honors degree in psychology, registering as an HBCSA counselor. That's kind of my next step up at this point in terms of qualifications, and then From there, it will be a master's in psychology. Yeah, that's me.
Thank you, Marina. Getting to ADHD, that is a condition that affects so many children and adults. And you know, in my personal experience, some of the most intelligent individuals I know. So I was very curious when I discovered that you look into how ADHD presents differently in men and women, and the fact that many women, because of this, remain undiagnosed. But before we go further, would you please explain what ADHD entails?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's such a great thing to start with, because just like you started the sentence by saying some of the most intelligent people I know have ADHD, right? And it goes back to that thing of, well, what on earth is this? Does it affect intelligence? Does it affect mood? What does it affect? And people on a general day-to-day basis don't quite know. And there's so many reasons why, and we will get into it. But one of the best explanations I've come across is from a clinical professor and neuropsychologist named Dr. Russell Barkley. Now, he dedicated his professional life to understanding ADHD better and did well over 4 decades of research. And in his book called Taking Charge of Adult ADHD, which I highly recommend to all individuals with ADHD listening in, basically he says that ADHD isn't actually a problem of attention. It's a disorder of self-regulation. The brain struggles with executive functions. Okay, and basically that means that it struggles with things like impulse control, working memory, emotional regulation, and motivation. In other words, people with ADHD can actually focus. It's not about a difficulty or a problem around focus. The issue lies around their ability to control and direct that focus in a consistent way. So it's not that they can't pay attention at all. It's that their brain has difficulty regulating when, where, and how to apply attention and effort. Okay. And basically, that's what classifies it as an executive dysfunction. All right. It's the brain's management, self-management skills. So effectively, an example or an analogy that I like to use, right, is a computer. When you log onto your computer and you open your internet browser, consider that your nucleus, your home in which you can access all information. So take that and compare that to the human brain. In a normal context, when you open a web browser page and you start getting different tabs going, you have one tab that's your email, one tab that's your internet banking, one tab that's giving you a how-to instruction on how to remove stains from your floor, another one that's a take-a-lot shopping tab, another tab that's there to help give you information for work. And basically, you'll see that as our brains kind of go through the day, we build and open more and more tabs. More and more things happen that we need to think about, and simultaneously, right? Now, the difference with the ADHD brain to the neurotypical brain is that the neurotypical brain can look at all these tabs and say, this one is the most important, this is the second, this is the third. I do this first, second, third. The ADHD brain, because of the executive dysfunction, so it's where, when, and how do I apply this attention, cannot differentiate or see one tab as being more important than the other. So all 20 tabs, one being how do I clean my toenails, and the other one being let me submit this invoice so I can get paid this month, in that time, in that moment, cannot be differentiated. What is more important and why? And so If you look at studies using brain imagery, there was one I'm thinking of in particular done by the National Institute on Drug Abuse, where they were basically able to prove that this is in fact a brain problem, a brain control center problem, by showing that ADHD brains have differences in their dopamine pathways. Dopamine is our reward hormone that's critical for motivation and focus. Okay. And so there's something that people say often around ADHD, which is that you follow the dopamine. That's right. It's saying that, hey, when people are ADHD and there's something that said just about being distracted or hyperactive, they are really missing the full picture. It's actually a fundamental difference in how the brain regulates effort, emotion, and even time perception. So, you know, I've shared the TAB example, and another one that's super relatable and anyone with ADHD is going to go, oh my God, yes, this is so relatable, is the hyper-focus versus distraction paradox. People with ADHD and anyone here with ADHD will put up their hand and say, oh, heck yes, can spend hours completely immersed in something they love. If it's gaming, crafting, or researching a topic they're passionate about. Yet they struggle or may struggle to focus for 60 seconds on a boring or routine task that doesn't interest them in their hearts. Why? This is because ADHD isn't a lack of attention, a lack of responsibility or accountability. The brain itself has difficulty regulating attention and putting that dopamine, that reward hormone, in a place where it might need to be. Okay. So the ADHD brain struggles to shift attention properly based on external demands. And instead, it tends to be drawn to highly stimulating or interesting tasks, while ignoring less engaging but potentially necessary responsibilities. Mm. And that's the fundamentals of what ADHD really encompasses.
Thank you, Marina. That is really illuminating. My next question is, which typical misunderstandings are attached to ADHD? You have referred to a few things.
Yeah, so it only keeps growing, Mariette. There's so much to share on this, and the misunderstandings are exponential. In fact, we could be here till tonight, but what I have decided to do is share three.
Okay.
That really have stood out to me. But yes, fundamentally, ADHD is one of the most misunderstood neurodevelopmental conditions out there. And this misinformation has led to so much stigma, misdiagnoses, and countless undiagnosed women struggling in silence. Now, the way ADHD is portrayed in media often looks like hyperactive little boys bouncing off walls. And this has shaped the way people think about it. But the reality is that it is so much more complex. So I think that what I want to start with is the fact that myth one, ADHD is just a childhood disorder. This is probably one of the most damaging misconceptions about ADHD. The reality is ADHD is a lifelong neurodevelopmental condition, and it doesn't magically disappear when you turn 18. And this misunderstanding largely comes from the way ADHD was historically studied. So for decades, researchers focused on children, particularly young boys. Why? Because their symptoms were more obvious and disruptive in classroom settings. But as research expanded and we started to do more longitudinal studies, they found that about 60% of children with ADHD symptoms continue to experience those symptoms in adulthood. That was a study done by the National Comorbidity Survey, and now in 2005. And so what happens is we think it goes away over time, but what it's actually doing is shifting in the way it presents. A hyperactive 7-year-old might not be climbing furniture when they're 35, but they might experience symptoms like mental restlessness, impulsivity, executive dysfunction still. And the key issue is that many doctors, and it's not to say that it's not growing or changing, but why this is still a myth that people think about is because people in professional settings still do believe this or see it and preach it. So it means that, yes, you know, a lot of people still look at outdated information. And so women in particular, they seek assistance in adulthood, might be dismissed or misdiagnosed with anxiety and depression. So that's myth number one. Myth number two, which goes back to the whole intelligence thing, is you can't have ADHD if you did well in school. Now, this is one of the reasons why women in particular go undiagnosed during childhood, because ADHD has long been associated with academic struggles. So when someone is high achieving, no one thinks to check for this. But people with ADHD, especially women, develop extreme coping mechanisms to compensate for their difficulties. So Dr. Sari Solden wrote a book called Women with ADHD, another must read. And she talks about the perfectionist mask, which is a phenomenon where women with ADHD put an enormous amount of effort into appearing organized, responsible, and capable, even when they're struggling internally. And so they rely on things like rigid routines, obsessive list making, pulling all-nighters, just to feel like they've got their ducks in a row, but they're mentally exhausted on the inside. So the problem is that perfectionism associated with ADHD comes at a price. Chronic stress, burnout, anxiety, and often an overwhelming sense of imposter syndrome. So it's quite real, and it's very, very possible to be highly intelligent, highly skilled, highly academically capable, and still be ADHD. Now, the final one that I really like to talk about, and also, again, big one, is that people with ADHD should just be trying harder to be more disciplined. And this is harmful as a myth because it turns a neurological condition into a moral failing for the individual. People assume that if someone with ADHD struggles with deadlines, focus, or organization, it's because they're not making an effort. And that's just absolutely not true. It's got nothing to do with laziness or willpower. It's really, as we mentioned earlier, a disorder of self-regulation and not motivation. So if you look at the ADHD brain in particular, its prefrontal cortex, which is responsible for cognitive processing and reasoning, and the dopamine pathways are different. Okay, they're different, which makes it harder to initiate tasks, sustain effort, regulate attention. So, no, it's not that people with ADHD can't focus. It's not that they don't want to start a task. And it's not that they don't care about deadlines. It's that their brain struggles to control where their focus goes, switch into action mode, and gauge how urgent something is. And yeah, those are the three main things that I really did want to share with you.
Thank you. Now we're coming to possible causes of ADHD. Could you tell us what your view is?
Yes, absolutely. So as someone who works as a coach, a lot of the information I have is things that I get from research papers. And even as a student registered counselor, you know, the information I get is from building in my expertise by doing continued professional development and getting those points. It's also through working with individuals who have ADHD within my coaching practice. And then, of course, it's relying on the world leaders and experts in the field to get this information from the source. So whatever I share around this really is, especially something like causes of ADHD and prognoses and treatments, what I have to share really does come from sources and is not something that I like to give a free opinion of. Yeah, purely just to be as ethical and aligned as possible with the information that is true and right. Now, if we look at the possible causes of ADHD, what we've seen in the past few decades with research is that ADHD is primarily driven by a combination of genetics, brain structure, function, and environmental influences. It's not just one thing. It's a complex interplay of various things. So number one that I think is important to talk about is the genetic link, because ADHD does run in families. If you have ADHD, chances are that you are not the only one in your family. Research consistently shows that ADHD has such a strong genetic component. In fact, a leading researcher in ADHD genetics, Dr. Stephen Ferrone, published his work in the Journal of Biological Psychiatry, and he found that ADHD is one of the most inheritable psychiatric conditions out there, with an inheritability rate of nearly 80%, okay? And that's pretty crazy. That's pretty much as genetically linked as something like your height. And so what does it mean? If a parent has ADHD, there's almost a 50% chance that the child is going to have it too. The second thing is that, as we mentioned earlier, the actual brain and structure of someone with ADHD is different. So genetics doesn't tell the whole story. What's so fascinating is that if you look at neuroimaging studies of ADHD, you'll see just how differently it's wired. And brain scans show that just certain areas of the ADHD brain are smaller and less active, but they're paths and processes that are just different to that of a neurotypical brain. And so you have to look at the fact that the prefrontal cortex, which is, again, as I mentioned, the part of the brain that's responsible for things like planning, decision-making, impulse control, develops more slowly in an ADHD brain. And then if you look at the amygdala and the hippocampus, which are parts of the brain involved, that are responsible for emotional regulation and memory, people with ADHD have smaller ones too. So it's interesting to see, but I always love to say and share that the neurodivergent brain is so special because of the way it just thinks differently. And you'll always find, and it's something so precious that I always try to encourage within all of my clients who do have ADHD, that your beautiful brain thinks differently, which means that you can come up with solutions, skills, tools, ideas that the neurotypical brain isn't going to really come up with. And I know that's a bit of a generalized statement, but it holds true. And it's a really great way to re-motivate someone, because when you start to hear these things, it can make you feel a little bit scared that your brain is a bit different, or it can make you feel a bit worried about your capability. And again, I have to really state that it doesn't mean you're not capable. It just means you're going to think differently. Now, the final thing I want to mention is environmental stuff. Because yes, it does play a role in ADHD, but it doesn't determine whether or not you'll have it. So if you look at environmental factors, they increase the likelihood of symptoms appearing, not whether you have ADHD or not. So things that one would really need to watch out for exposure to stress, smoking, alcohol, poor nutrition. These are really important. Studies even show that poor nutrition during pregnancy can increase the risk of a kid developing ADHD. And, you know, even lead exposure in early childhood has been linked to higher rates of ADHD. So there's lots of things around the environment that I think is worth mentioning as something that can exacerbate ADHD symptoms.
Thank you, Marina. You recently told me that researchers now realize that ADHD can present differently in men and women. How did this realization come about? You have been referring to the history of research, which played a role in that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And such an interesting topic to discuss. I'm so excited that we have a space to share it here. So basically, for decades, ADHD was thought to be a condition that primarily affected young boys, right? We mentioned that. And so if you look back at early ADHD research from the 70s and 80s, nearly all the studies were conducted on Caucasian, hyperactive school boys because they were the ones who were being brought into clinics. They were the ones referred by teachers. And so they were the ones that were then studied in medical settings. Why? Because these young boys were more likely to exhibit externalized symptoms, making it easier to identify. The reason why women have not been studied nearly as much is because girls in school settings were and are less likely to be disruptive. They, in general, if you look at a girl's kind of temperament, it is a generalized statement, but girls tend to be more agreeable, right? And so if you look at the way that girls present ADHD symptoms, they are the ones who often are considered the daydreamers, the ones that struggled with organization, the ones that experienced internalized anxiety. And because they weren't causing classroom disruption, their symptoms were basically just overlooked. And so this male-centric model of ADHD shaped everything from the diagnostic criteria to the way ADHD is treated. And girls and women weren't even really considered in this process. As a result, generations of women have gone undiagnosed or misdiagnosed and struggling pretty silently with these symptoms that looked very different from the textbook examples of boys. And so it really wasn't until the early 2000s where large-scale studies started revealing just how much ADHD in women had been ignored. And one of the first major voices in this conversation was Dr. Kathleen Nadeau. I never really say her name right, Nadeau, along with Dr. Patricia Quinn and Dr. Ellen Littman. And they started a study in the early 2000s, a big one on how ADHD affected women in particular. Now, this is what they found. Number one, girls with ADHD were missed in school because their symptoms were internalized, not disruptive. Many of these girls grew into women who never knew or considered ADHD. They just thought they had anxiety, depression, and were bad at doing life. And then women with ADHD were more likely to struggle with emotional regulation, low self-esteem, and chronic anxiety. Yet were really screened for ADHD because they didn't fit the profile of the hyperactive schoolboy. And so as this started to happen in the early 2000s, and people started to realize even from the late 90s that so much medical data was skewed towards men because men had been the predominant gender that was considered for studies up until the 2000s. There was suddenly this uproar saying, hey, we have to study women. And so by the 2010s, more and more research started to confirm that ADHD in women was vastly underdiagnosed. And this is also where stuff like self-advocacy and awareness grew, thanks to books like what I just said, Women with ADHD by Sari Solden, really worth reading. You know, Radical Guide for Women with ADHD, and my personal favorite, Scattered Minds by Dr. Gabor Mate. And this kind of started to pave the path for growth in this concern.
Before we come to how ADHD presents in women, you were talking about internalized symptoms. Could we just establish a foundation and look at how ADHD typically presents in men?
Absolutely. So as I touched on earlier, for decades, researchers really focused on the hyperactive, disruptive behavior, which is commonly seen in males. And so this led to one particular stereotype, the classic ADHD presentation in men. And this is the man who cannot sit still, fidgets, taps, moves, disruptive in school, interrupting, blurting out answers, getting into trouble, takes impulsive, you know, risks, speaking without thinking, acting on impulse. It's someone who might be more prone to doing or having high-risk behavior. They drive too fast, engage with thrill-seeking activities. These are also individuals who might be easily distracted, that drift off mid-conversation, and so on. But there's also the daydreaming or inattentive man. And this is basically where hyperactivity is more commonly seen in men, while some don't have extreme physical restlessness. So these men, the overlooked men, the inattentive men, are men that might zone out frequently. They struggle to stay present in conversations. These are men who forget important details like meetings, deadlines, or even just things that their partners have told them. They have difficulty planning and organizing tasks, and they might even appear lazy or unmotivated, even though their brain is constantly overwhelmed with thoughts. And so what we've seen and what you'll find in men most often is that, number one, men and with ADHD that is untreated, is that number one, they have high rates of job instability, frequent career changes, difficulty in maintaining focus at work. They show or showcase impulsivity in finances, overspending, impulsive purchases. They might struggle with relationships due to forgetfulness or lack of emotional regulation. And then finally, one that can't be ignored is that there is definitely a risk of substance abuse with adult men who are untreated. And why? Because it's a way to self-medicate the symptoms of ADHD for themselves, especially if they're suffering.
And then in women?
So if you look at women, right, it definitely is something to say straight off the bat that it is different. The realization that ADHD presents differently in men and women didn't happen overnight. It was a very gradual shift over decades that was fueled by key researchers who challenged this male-centric ADHD model. So instead of the hyperactive little boy stereotype, what women with ADHD often experience is, number one, emotional dysregulation, intense mood swings, rejection sensitivity, difficulty managing frustration, chronic overwhelm and burnout, women struggling to juggle responsibilities leading to exhaustion, hyperfocus and perfectionism, trying to mask the struggles by being super organized, and then again, having inattention masked by anxiety. So, you know, instead of being disruptive, many women internalize their ADHD and appear just scatterbrained. And also the women who are high functioning are often pretty successful by appearance. but just on the inside, I'm mentally exhausted from overcompensating. So if we have to put them side by side now, what we could say is that men show external symptoms like hyperactivity and impulsivity. Men are diagnosed earlier because their symptoms are more disruptive. Men struggle with impulse control, so risk-taking, blurting out things they shouldn't, financial impulsivity, and they're more prone to addiction or thrill-seeking behaviors. Women, on the other hand, show internal symptoms like chronic overwhelm, overthinking, anxiety. They tend to be diagnosed later because they're more likely to mask their symptoms. And they struggle with perfectionism and burnout rather than hyperactivity. And they also experience intense emotional sensitivity, and it's called rejection sensitive dysphoria. So those are the main differences that you'll find in men and women.
Marina, I was wondering, the symptoms specific to women, would they appear in this way in all age groups? In other words, would you also see them in girls?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Mariette. So yes, the core traits of ADHD, such as inattention, impulsivity, and difficult with self-regulation, they're present at every age. However, the way it presents in young girls versus adult women will look different depending on the developmental, social, and environmental factors. So what you'll find is that adult women experience additional layers of stress that intensify their symptoms. So ADHD symptoms in women basically just evolve and manifest differently. So a good example of this could be time blindness, right? The difficulty to estimate how long things will take. Girls may be seen as spacey, lost in their own world, daydreaming in class, staring out of a window, listening. Women might be forgetful or miss deadlines, not because she's careless, but because time blindness makes it harder to track what's urgent. So that's kind of a good example. Or potentially another one would be, let's take emotional sensitivity, right? The intense feeling of emotions that makes you struggle to regulate, right? Girls may seem too sensitive. Girls may seem like they just cry easily. They might feel deeply affected by criticism or become anxious over small things. Women struggle with emotional dysregulation, overreaction to minor frustration, crying easily, feeling like they can't control their emotions. So that's kind of the main difference. Yeah, girls with ADHD may not recognize their struggles yet because they have external support, parents, teachers, and structure. Women with ADHD have to manage everything themselves. This leads to the whole burnout, anxiety, exhaustion cycle, and often a reason why then it's diagnosed so much later.
Thank you. I wanted to ask you something from a completely different direction, and that is whether you think trauma plays a role in the experience or intensity of ADHD symptoms.
Oof. What a question. This is a big question in ADHD research right now. Does childhood trauma or even adult trauma contribute? And so far, what research seems to understand is that ADHD itself is not caused by trauma. It's a neurodevelopmental disorder, but it can mimic or worsen ADHD symptoms. So again, in the book I suggested earlier called Scattered Minds by Dr. Gabor Maté, he suggests that children with ADHD are more sensitive to emotional stress. And so early trauma is not only more prevalent, but can then also intensify ADHD traits. And that children with ADHD are more likely to experience rejection, criticism, and low self-esteem, which can increase anxiety and dysregulation and can lead to more trauma. And so it's a challenging loop, but it's become important to separate cause from effect. So what we know is that trauma does not cause ADHD directly as a direct link, okay? But it can significantly amplify ADHD symptoms, making them more intense or prevalent or easy to see and harder to manage, and even more difficult to distinguish from other mental conditions. So something happens, and what was undetectable as ADHD before now becomes very detectable, in other words. So ADHD and childhood trauma often coexist. And studies show that people with ADHD are more likely to experience traumatic life events. So a study published in the European Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Journal found that people with ADHD were significantly more likely to have experienced childhood trauma as like neglect, abuse, or high conflict environments. So it's really, really interesting. And so one of the challenges we're finding now, right, is even certain other mental health conditions overlapping with ADHD. And so ADHD research is trying to understand whether this as a whole or as a condition can mimic PTSD or vice versa, because they share so many overlapping symptoms. Trauma can also lead to PTSD, right? And so what we're finding is that there's such an overlap in symptoms. Number one, difficulty concentrating, present in both individuals with ADHD and PTSD. Hypervigilance or distractibility, almost living in survival mode, not being able to focus. That's also prevalent in PTSD. Impulsivity and emotional reactivity or sleep disturbances. And so one of the challenges is that women might come with an incredibly traumatic background or past and are diagnosed incorrectly with PTSD or anxiety, or even something like fibromyalgia, because of the fact that ADHD can present in physical symptoms instead of a confounding diagnosis, ADHD. And this happens a lot with me, where I'll get women coming into my coaching practice that say, I've got fibromyalgia, I've got this pain, I've got that pain. And then I'll ask them, have you ever been diagnosed with ADHD? And they go, oh, yeah, I did that as a kid, but I don't know why that's important right now. And I'm like, oh, actually, it's pretty damn important because ADHD actually answers a lot of those why am I feeling this way question once you have other comorbidities. So, yeah, very, very interesting.
Now, you've mentioned that ADHD can manifest in physical symptoms. Could you say a little more about that?
Yes, absolutely. So it's quite new to see, and it's quite a new concept and understanding that ADHD does not only showcase in mental health symptoms, but actually physical symptoms too. But the research really does show that the way ADHD presents, right? And we've spoken tremendously about the fact that it can lead to individuals leading lives in hypervigilant states and always kind of in this survival zone, right? Is incredibly unhealthy for the body. Why? Because if anyone is in a state of hypervigilance where their flight or fight response is continually activated, what it means is that their body is always releasing cortisol, the stress hormone that is responsible for helping you make quick decisions when you are under imminent threat or danger. That is when our fight or flight is meant to get activated. Now, people with ADHD, especially left untreated, who cannot understand why life is as hard as it is, why it's so difficult to keep up, as mentioned, can develop hypervigilance, so feeling like they've always got to be extra alert, always have to be in that state of fight or flight because there's an imminent threat if they're not hypervigilant, have now or often get into a cycle of not knowing how to then regulate and come down from that heightened state and stop that increase in cortisol production in their bodies. And so if cortisol as the stress hormone stays in your system consistently for a very, very long time, it's really bad for you. It is considered highly toxic in high doses, and it does lead to inflammation within the body itself. So a mental distressing symptom, like feeling like you're under threat, releases a physical hormone into your body, cortisol, which is toxic in high doses and causes inflammation in your physical body, which can then present in physical symptoms like pain and difficulty breathing. Think about it not even as just from a chronic perspective, but think about it just in general. If you are stressed because something could attack you, could hurt you, you'll find you have certain physical symptoms that come up. Maybe it's that you have to give a big speech, and so your hands start to shake and your palms get sweaty and you start to stutter. Maybe you've got really bad news and your stomach starts to hurt and your head starts to spin. These are all signs that when we are emotionally dysregulated, our physical bodies have a response. And the same applies to people, especially women who go untreated with ADHD into their adult lives.
Thank you. That is very lucidly explained. What can help women who may be living with ADHD to have the condition diagnosed sooner rather than later?
Look, education is right at the top there, for sure. The first step in helping women get diagnosed earlier is changing that outdated narrative about ADHD. Learning, being right here, listening to this podcast, giving yourself the space to understand means that you now have not only the ability to share this information, but you're almost responsible for it, because it is through education and enlightenment that we can start to say goodbye to the stereotypes that just do not serve and aren't good for us. So education and enlightenment is absolutely the first step. You know, three of my closest friends all have ADHD. And so what was really important to me within our friendship is that they articulated very carefully and honestly what it was that they struggled with and what it was that they needed from me. And so if you're someone who is friends with or has a family member with ADHD, your job would be to listen, and not to listen with judgment, to purely just listen. The second thing I'd say is, as we do with, or as I've created with my chronic illness organization, the second thing that is so valuable is having a support community for women in particular, because it becomes very powerful for women to be in a circle and, after hearing other stories, be able to go, oh my God, that's me. Because ADHD can feel so isolating. But if you can come together, the studies show that there's less self-blame, there's more self-acceptance when you can connect with others who have gone through or have the same struggles. And finally, I think that through having these open and vulnerable conversations, by seeking to educate, you do the third thing very well, which is normalize this as a conversation. A big barrier to early ADHD diagnoses in women is that women blame themselves for their struggles rather than recognizing a neurodevelopmental difference. So women and girls tend to go, I just need to be more disciplined, or I'm not trying hard enough, or, you know, why can't I handle life like other people? And so making sure that that you can identify those thoughts and say, hey, actually, if I'm thinking this way, then maybe I'm not the problem. And that falls into the lap of moms who have young daughters, that falls into the laps of teachers who are witnessing and watching their beautiful girls grow in school, to pick out that behavior, that lack of self-confidence, pushing, girls who push themselves down, and be pillars of reason to say, hey, I see this, let's get you some help. There's also, if you are an ADHDer, there's a nice podcast for you to also listen to by Kristen Carter called I Have ADHD. So go and listen up, go and learn. It's so valuable.
Marina, let's look at treatment. Firstly, how are the symptoms traditionally associated with ADHD? As you indicated, the male-centered studies, how are they usually treated?
So I have to say that what we'll find is that women and men tend to have and need the same things. There are one or two discrepancies and differences. But right now, what medicine has provided us is actual medication. So there is medication available for both men and women to help regulate focus, impulse control, and executive function. However, as a lot of people will know, medication isn't a one-size-fits-all solution. Some people may respond incredibly well, others don't. Others find that they still need therapy or behavioral strategies to function effectively. But in essence, yeah, medication is an option, and every person or professional you speak to will give you a different perspective on whether or not they believe in it. I take the opinion and view of Switzerland here. If it works for you, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. It doesn't mean that it's your only solution. It doesn't mean that it's your only thing you can look at. Because if medicine isn't your thing for whatever reason, you will still need, men or women will need, therapy and coaching in some way to build coping skills, to manage emotional dysregulation, and just to improve daily functions. So having someone you can trust to help you work through these things and be there to guide you is really important. And there are very specific ADHD coaches. I'm not quite sure how many are in South Africa at the moment, but that have designed coaching practices really around the ADHD brain, you know, where you end up not having a 1 hour sit down because that's just not what all ADHDers want, where you can have 15 minute calls every day instead of a 1 hour, one a week. So there's lots of people that are really designing systems for the ADHD brain. And then, of course, you know, lifestyle, no matter who you are or what you have, it's really imperative to know that when you support your brain function, no matter what condition you have, through structure, exercise, sleep, and nutrition, you're going to be ahead of the game. You're going to be absolutely fine. If you feed yourself the right foods, you're going to have a positive effect on the symptoms of your ADHD because of the fact that things like caffeine and sugar and alcohol have a bad impact on ADHD, right? So that's really important. Another thing is exercise, such an important way to emotionally regulate. You know, I would, if I could, prescribe it because it's great. But again, my recommendation, if you do have ADHD and you do want to start changing your diet or exercising or anything like that, speak to your medical professional because they'll know your case and they'll be able to give you trustworthy advice that you can follow and really work with that and ask them in their fields. That'll be something that I would do in my own sessions, is just refer someone to the right professional who can assist with those functions, because they're equally important. So it's definitely not a one size fits all, but highly important to look at exercise, nutrition, sleep hygiene, and external structures like reminders, planners, alarms. I know that one of my best friends who is ADHD has channeled or does an exercise every day that really helps her. And that is, she has an alarm on her phone that goes off every hour on the hour. And it says, as the alarm goes off, it says, where are you and what are you doing? And so she's able to, in that moment, reconfigure, stop, see if she's gotten off track, see if she's still doing things that she should be, and how far she is, and get herself back into a flow that is productive or that goes in the right direction.
How can the symptoms of ADHD as experienced by women be treated? You have indicated that there's not that much difference, but maybe there's something else you'd like to mention.
I think there's one core thing that I'd really like to share about women with ADHD, and that is to check up on how your own particular menstrual cycle affects your ADHD symptoms, because the two are actually incredibly linked. Again, depending on which week of your menstrual cycle you're in, your hormones are going to fluctuate, and your hormones play a big role in the symptoms you experience. So you'll find that women who are on stimulant medication like Concerta find that their medication is actually less effective before their periods, and it needs adjusting. So women with ADHD, definitely look at your cycle and take that into account. And then if there is one thing I can add, just from a side note, is make sure that whatever therapy you choose to do, whether it's coaching, mentoring, counseling, psychotherapy, have a focus on self-compassion. Many women really do struggle with chronic self-criticism and burnout from years of masking. And so highlight the fact that self-compassion should really be a strong feature you focus on.
A quick note on what I do. I'm a content entrepreneur creating podcasts and articles on living a happier and healthier life by interviewing coaches, therapists, and other wellness experts from over the world. You'll find this content on my website, www.marietsneeman.co.za, and it's there to help you find just the right helping professional when you need one. This section, Up Close and Personal, on my website, offers you a glimpse of the person behind many of the experts I feature. If you're a wellness expert keen on getting more in-person or online clients, or creating worldwide awareness of an issue close to your heart, let's talk about co-creating a podcast or article, or perhaps featuring you in a South African magazine. You'll find more information under Services on my website. To each listener, no matter your age, occupation, or where you live, how about creating your very own personal audio recording with me as a one-of-a-kind gift to someone you deeply care for? In this private interview with me, you can express your love for your partner, leave a legacy to your children or grandchildren, honor your mum or dad or a mentor. The possibilities are endless. To find out more, just click on Gift Podcasts on my website. Now, back to my guest. Since you're a coach, I wanted to ask you, when you see a female client who may have ADHD, how do you journey with her?
It's such a challenging question, that, because one of the biggest challenges, as we've mentioned, that women with ADHD face is that delayed diagnosis. So many women don't realize they have ADHD until adulthood, and then you know, they struggle with chronic overwhelm, anxiety, perfectionism, or burnout for years. And so what makes me so happy is that all these things, like overwhelm, like anxiety, like perfectionism, if we know that there's an ADHD diagnosis behind there, we can really say, hey, actually, I've got information for you that's going to put your mind at ease. And I've got exercises for you that are going to help you grow out of this mindset. And so what I like to do, and as part of my practical advice for women living with ADHD too, is number one, we work with your brain and not against it. And that's a journey that you go on as an individual too, because many women with ADHD spend years blaming themselves for struggling with things that seemed easy for others, like remembering appointments, keeping a clean house, finishing projects on time. And the truth is your brain works just so differently, and that's okay. And so we tap into why that is or how that is and start to create a lot of mental notes around, it's okay. You are safe. Your brain is not working against you. The world is not working against you. And so it goes in with the practical advice I offer. And what we do sometimes is we'll look at what are the main challenges with your brain function. So maybe it's about bringing in external structures to support memory. ADHD isn't a failure of intelligence. It's a failure of working memory. So alarms, sticky notes, digital planners, visual cues. We also work on finding ways to make boring tasks more engaging by either creating systems that help you follow dopamine in a different way. We also do things like body doubling, where you work alongside someone else. And then, of course, we take a very long time to break tasks down into micro steps. So instead of saying, I need to clean the whole kitchen and that's your job for today, you know, we're going to break down what it means to clean the kitchen by honestly just starting with loading the dishwasher or rinsing the plates, right? So that's one of the ways that, and something that I really like to help my clients and be there for them. And the second thing is to offer the community I have as part of their kind of healing, because they get to speak to other people with ADHD who can resonate and connect and help.
Do you have more practical advice for individuals living with ADHD?
Yes, absolutely. So there's things you can do when you leave, you know, the coach or the mentor or the psychotherapist's room, that you can take into your daily life and remember all the time. But number one, something that ADHD women in particular struggle with is learning to say no and overcommitting so much. And so one thing that I implore if you're on this journey is to really start thinking about how many years you've spent masking your struggles or trying to prove you're capable. And it's led you to burnout, resentment, and exhaustion, right? And so the first thing I want to share is, you know, learn to say no and give yourself permission to pause. Instead of instantly saying yes, start responding to things with, let me check my schedule and get back to you. And something that I like to do is use the hell yes or hell no rule. If someone asks you something, and it's not a, oh, hell yes, I want to do that, then it's a no. ADHD brains thrive when they're passionate. So be selective with your commitments. When someone asks you something and you don't have a, oh, hell yes response, don't do it. And so that's the one thing. And the second thing I'd have to say is when it comes to task switching and that feeling of overwhelm or kind of action paralysis, I know that procrastination is a huge struggle for women with ADHD, not because you're lazy, but because task initiation paralysis is just a real thing. So the trick, something I like to say to people with ADHD, if a task takes less than 2 minutes, do it right now. If it's about putting a dish in the sink, replying to a short message, getting back to someone, if it takes 2 minutes, do it immediately. If the task is bigger than 2 minutes, just start with 2 minutes. Often that small action is actually enough to build momentum for you. So an example would be if you're avoiding writing a long email, just tell yourself you're going to write the subject headline, and that's going to take you 2 minutes. And then you'll often find that once you start, even if it wasn't a task you wanted to do, you're likely just going to keep going.
Oh, that's good advice for anyone.
Yes, I think you're right.
You have touched on your services. Is there anything else you'd like to mention?
I think that's mainly just for anybody who is listening in and is struggling with the fact that you have neurodivergent tendencies or are neurodivergent and suffer with something like ADHD, that you know that what we have and what we can share within the space is really all about, number one, creating safety, number two, making you feel heard, and number three, giving you the resources that you may need for your own particular journey. So yes, we offer one-on-one personal counseling and coaching, but we also have group and community offerings where we have get-togethers and events. We have support groups. We've got chats and forums. And we also have resources like our blog, our podcast, and our emailer, where we really can get ample information. So if you're struggling to know where to start with that education process of knowing what's out there, and we really can be quite helpful to you.
Where can listeners learn more about this?
So you can go straight to my website, www.healwithmarina.com. In it, I share and have absolutely everything, and you can sign up to our newsletter there. You can become part of our premium membership community. You can also join our WhatsApp group from there and reach out for private coaching. So it's really the best place to go.
I will attach that link to the podcast, you know, just in case someone is listening while they're driving.
That's perfect. Thank you.
Yeah. Now, may I ask you your fun question?
I am so excited for my fun question.
A little bird told me that you love music, especially the piano. Was that little bird right?
Yes, that little bird was right. I've played the piano since I was four, actually. I love it. And it's been an important part of my ability to express without words throughout my life, to have fun and to engage with others in a way that doesn't really require words or anything other than just love and passion for what music can offer you.
Yeah. Now, that was just preparation for your fun question. My question is, if you could spend a day with any composer, living or not with us anymore, who would it be?
I think because of the fact that I'm so fascinated by how chronic illness and disability plays such a role in your life and how it changes things, I would be so fascinated to learn from Beethoven, because as we know, he was hard of hearing, he was deaf, and yet was able to compose the most incredible music of our time. And so first, it would be a challenge for me as someone who is partially deaf myself. It would give me a challenge to brush up on my sign language and also really sit and connect with someone who was able to build a career regardless of quite a major obstacle in their lives. Yeah, definitely.
So beautifully said. Thank you, Marina, and thank you for these insights you share today. I've learned a lot I didn't know, and I do hope that this will make a big contribution, that our understanding of neurodivergent brains will get better. Thank you very much.
It's such a pleasure, Maria, to not only be a speaker on your incredible channel and podcast, but to be able to share such valuable and important information. So know that it's been nothing but an honor to sit here with you and have this discussion today. Thank you very much.
And to our listeners, it was good of you to join us. I'd be honored if you'd subscribe to this podcast series. And if you found this episode meaningful, please share it with someone you care about. Go to my website, www.marietsneeman.co.za, for this episode's podcast notes and for free podcasts and articles on how to live a happier and healthier life and have more fulfilling relationships. To follow me on Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn, just search for Mariette Sneeman Journalist. The podcast series, Calm, Clear and Helpful, is produced by me with original music by Mart Marie Sneeman. Catch you next Tuesday at 9.